This is an ABC podcast.
Drinking and smoking, along with insulting customers, were the hallmarks of bookstore owner Bernard Black. He was played with gleeful, wild-haired abandon by the Irish comedian Dylan Moran. Black Books became a cult hit in Britain and here in Australia too. And it was Dylan's big break. He now fills auditoriums around the world, from Moscow to Wollongong. Like his alter ego Bernard in Black Books, Dylan used to smoke and drink a lot. But facing 50, he has quit all of that. He's been in Australia touring his latest stand-up show, Dr. Cosmos. Hi, Dylan.
Hey, hi, thank you.
You have toured Australia many times, Dylan. How do audiences here compare to the UK or the US?
I don't know. It's something that's very easily quantifiable. You know, there probably are subtle differences.
But you couldn't do a blind test and say, just take you out into a room and you could tell through your waters what country you were in.
Maybe you could put me in front of a room and fill it full of people and not tell me where they were from, and I could sort of, by where they were laughing, possibly I could tell you where they were from or the way they were laughing. Maybe. That's an interesting idea.
Do you work off a script?
Yes, I do. But the show comes out in a different way every night. And I don't know how different it is. I'm doing loads of the same routines as far as I can work out, because I rely on those as handholds to get me from one side of the time to the other, you know? But everything moves around.
And so what for you, I mean, I guess beyond people laughing, what makes a show feel like a success? When do you end a gig and think, yeah, okay, that was interesting to me, or that was meaningful to me?
Well, it's when you get to change something or, you know, when you get to play it upside down or sideways or inside out, you know, that's kind of the fun of it. But to be honest with you, that's not the fun that the audience know about necessarily. I mean, what happens is that you get more animated when you're having more fun yourself, so your performance is better overall, and then people enjoy it, you know, because of that. But to be honest with you, and this is something that, you know, is weird for these conversations, the way that happens most is when I'm least self-conscious about it. And all of these questions, and all of the questions journalists ask me all the time over the period of 30 years that I've been doing this, none of them, and this is totally fair enough when you think about it, none of them ever seem to know that, ever. Because, and if you think about it, it's fine, because what's happening is, once you set up this paradigm of an interview like this, what's happening is you're saying, you're there in this glass box and I'm outside the glass asking you questions. That's the arrangement. And the thing is, the answers I give in that basis won't be, they'll tell you some stuff, but if you set it up so that it's, you're from the outside and you're asking somebody about the inside, I can answer the questions, but when it comes to the performance, I'm doing the absolute opposite. I never, ever think about this stuff, because it's death to performance. It's death to being on stage.
Do you think that's unique to comics to not think about it? Like, I guess dancers have to
I think it's the same for dancers. I think it's the same for jazz musicians. I think it's the same for anything where anybody has to absolutely throw themselves into something. Because there are people who are much cleverer than me who probably can do the two things, where you can simultaneously jump out the window and be busy cogitating about how you're going to fall or how you're going to land. But I cannot do that. I've heard some classical musicians talk, and it sounds a bit like that. If you listen to Glenn Gould talk about a piece of music, because he made lots of radio programs himself about music. So when you listen to him expound on, you know, Beethoven, for example, or, you know, extrapolate the mechanics of something, well, you think there's a brain that can simultaneously analyze what he's performing. I don't have that kind of mind.
Well, I guess also it's different as he's talking about something he's playing that someone else has written, but you're talking about, I don't know, you're pulling it out of your insides in a different
way.
You
are, yeah. So pulling it out of your insides is a good way to put it. If you think of it as sort of a, you know, a metaphorical handkerchief that you're just sort of pulling out of a pocket, really, a magician's handkerchief. I don't stand there going blue, red, dotted, silk, whatever. I just go, this one, that one, and this one. You know what I mean? Because if I did try to parse everything as I was going along, I wouldn't get out the front door.
So if it's not about having a kind of critical self-awareness, which makes sense, what's the useful head state for you to be in before you go on stage? So you're thinking about something else. Being a child.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, when you're a child, you walk out the back door, you go into the yard and you mess around. You don't think about, oh, I'm going to, you know, chase a butterfly or fall over a rock, or think about climbing a tree, but then be too scared and end up drinking three lemonades. you have an afternoon. So I go out there and I, you know, I have an evening with everybody else.
Tell me about where you were when you were a child, Dylan. What part of Ireland did you grow up in?
I grew up in County Meath, sort of, you know, borders Dublin.
Is it not beautiful, the way we think of Ireland, postcard
no,
picture being beautiful?
It's flat and green, it has cows, it rains. Kind of, you know, 40 different kinds of damp coming at you, marching at you.
Was it a fun place to be a child?
It's good to be a little kid, and then you get to be a teenager and, you know, you're howling.
Why? What's
Well, because, you know, you're not in the city. You want to be hanging out in the city with your, you know, friends bombing around, you know. So you had a town, all the like-minded kids sought each other out to moan about, you know, the no music and the no art galleries and all the rest of it. And then we'd go up to Dublin.
I mean, that's the thing, I think, when you grow up somewhere that you're just desperate to leave. But I guess it forces you into inventing stuff.
Yeah,
yourself.
We did. It was good for that. It was good for that. We really did make our own fun, as the, you know, phrase that has driven countless children insane, probably. But we did, because there were a lot of rainy days and there was a lot of nothing around us. So, you know, you get inventive.
What sort of stuff would you do?
Well, just talk. It was all talking. It was all hanging out, talking, making each other laugh. That was as good as it got, you know. So you put a lot of effort and time into it, and that's what you were doing all the time, you know. And I was drawing and writing as well, but, you know, you know, my friends were people who were interested in doing similar stuff, taking photos or painting or whatever, you know. And then, you know, you hang around in cafes and you shoot the breeze. Can't even remember the name of it, but, you know, we just wanted somewhere to be where we weren't at home, you know, where we could get out and talk, hang out.
So this was Ireland in the 1970s and 80s, mm-hmm. Was it an incredibly religious place for you?
Yeah, it was. Well, it's interesting. I think about it now, looking back every now and again, so I'll remember something. And I remembered, I think it was around 1984, there was this wave of, it's hysteria, really. It's amazing. Somebody needs to do a movie about it. I must do something about this. There was a wave of religious sightings, these visions people had, moving statues. I don't know, you might remember.
Yeah, we heard about it here. Yeah. They were held up as Holy Island.
It was a huge deal. It was a huge deal. And it was hysteria. And really, it was about what it was about was the death of religion. That, you know, because that was really when the whole thing was beginning to, the cracks in the edifice had appeared and the whole thing was about to die. And that's the last, sort of last gasp of it. It's religion being exorcised by modernity from Ireland, really. And that's how it expressed itself, through these hysterical sightings.
Often kids seeing statues move and
statues
and
bleeding, talking to them, coming at them, you know, wild. Really.
Was your family itself a religious one?
No, we didn't go to church.
That must have been unusual.
Yeah, it was. At the time, I didn't think about it too much, but yeah, it was. It was, definitely. You know, when you're a kid, you're not aware of all those things. I mean, now, you know, if I had children in that context and they weren't going to church, I might be aware that things might be difficult for them, but I wasn't aware of it at the time.
Were you still exposed to Catholicism just through your friends' houses?
Everywhere. It was all around. It's in the air. It's prayers everywhere. Jesus everywhere. You know, the churches controlled all the schools, for one thing. So they literally ran the country's educational system. I mean, there would have been, I suppose, back then, one or two independent schools. I certainly didn't know about them.
So how, like, give me an example of where you'd be, or if you'd be at a friend's place, or if you'd be on the street and that religious culture was something you'd come up against?
Well, there was, you know, there was a general sense of, you know, having to be very respectful around priests and all that sort of stuff. But I didn't grow up that I didn't pay too much attention to it. But I guess it was just sort of, it was what you're aware of was a tremendous waste of everybody's time. That's what I was aware of, you know, in the observances and having to tiptoe around this, that and the other. Because I didn't grow up in a religious house, and because you were led to believe that that was, you know, slightly strange.
If your family weren't religious, does that mean you managed to escape that sort of inheritance of shame and guilt that a lot of people who came from Catholic backgrounds talk about?
I think everybody is encouraged to feel bad. Yeah, everybody was encouraged to feel bad about being alive and their own incredible potential for sin.
And was that something you had a bit of distance from, given that your family wasn't wrapped up in going to church?
A bit, but, you know, the thing is, you don't exist in isolation, you exist with other people, so it pervades everything, it's in all your relationships, it's in everything. And then, you know, later, as an adult, or, you know, looking back, I mean, it's kind of the last generation of that, I think, because by the time I was in my 30s or whatever, Ireland was starting to completely transform, you know, and become a modern European country and leave all that behind, really. And it's kind of, it's done now, but it wasn't done then.
Did you still have to go through the sacraments like communion and confirmation?
Yeah, you know, but they're just kind of days where you put on funny clothes and adults give you money.
And what did you spend your money on that you got from those sorts of things?
I spent my money on underground comics, Robert Crumb comics and all that sort of stuff.
Where would you go to get them?
There was one shop in Dublin that sold those things. I don't know how I even knew about it. I was 12 and I remember going up and spending all my money there.
Robert Crumb, like, that's a fairly extreme example.
I know. I don't think my parents knew or minded or decided they didn't mind or whatever it was, but it was that, all that stuff and the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers and all that sort of stuff, all the San Francisco stuff.
Things were bad in Northern Ireland back then. Were you aware of that?
You know, I mean, it seemed quite distant to us as a child. It did anyway, because it was Ireland, but it was somewhere, you know, you never went particularly. And that backdrop of death and fear was there all the time. It was the backdrop, you know, again, when I was quite, you know, growing up. And then when I was older, I was up there for a little while myself. I lived up there for a little while.
What took you to Northern Ireland, Dylan?
Oh, I went up there to another school for a bit. And then, you know, so having lived in the south where I grew up and then up there for a couple of years and then in Britain, I saw it from all sides, saw the conversation from all sides, which is still ongoing, as you know, with Brexit and all that rubbish. So,
was it a frightening place to be, Dylan?
Yeah, the news was very scary when I was small. People died. People were shot dead. You know, it was constant. There was a period when it happened every week, it seemed. You know, there was a death. God, it definitely seemed that way. It was very grim. When you hear about death, you know, on the lunchtime news every day in your own country, it is grim. It was very depressing. I mean, I suppose for me, because I didn't experience it directly, you know, when I was younger, it sort of just seemed to fold into the kind of Ireland's problems or Ireland's, what was keeping Ireland back, or Ireland's depression, if you like, because there was a recession as well. And there was quite a bleak time when I was sort of in my teens, 16, 17, 18, when you're trying to figure out what the hell you're going to do, you know?
What was school like for you as a teenager?
I was just pretty unhappy. I didn't. You know, enjoy it very much. There were one or two sort of teachers I got on with who made a big difference, really. Any kind of, you know, kindness, I think, simply just makes a big difference from teachers. A bit of interest. They say, oh, you know, you seem to have some ability there, and maybe talk to you about it a little bit. It goes a long way. It's never wasted, that stuff.
What do you think they would have expected for you, or what would have been considered a good job for you to
move
into?
At the time, it was all very much keeping people within, you know, very, very established boundaries of, you know, dentistry or, you know, accountants and all that sort of stuff.
I think you would have been a terrifying dentist.
I don't think I would have been much good as a dentist. I'm glad I'm not a dentist. I'm very bad in the dentist chair, so I would have been very bad holding the instruments. I sing when I'm in a dentist chair, so God knows what I would do if I was a dentist. For years I was terrified of the dentist. The only way I could get through it was to actually sing while I was in the chair. I would explain beforehand, it's the only way I can deal with this.
As they have their hands in your mouth.
As they were doing their stuff, yeah. Obviously it wasn't very good singing, but it got me through it. Just kind of loud, quite Glenn Gouldish humming, actually. But going back to Glenn Gould. But,
so it was dentistry or accountancy?
Dentistry or death, yeah. And, you know, that wasn't going to work, obviously, so...
So what on earth led you to think that comedy might be a viable way of escaping that?
That was just random, you know. That was just up in Dublin with some friends, and we looked in on this club for an evening, and I didn't think it would be up to much, but I was very impressed and thought, you know, I'd been writing stuff. I was writing stupid, funny stuff before then, so I thought, okay, great, this is something I can do. And I went on the next week and did 5 minutes, and that was it. I didn't look back, really.
1 week after seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, I said, can I come on next week and do 5? And they said, sure, and that was it. That really was it. I was very lucky because the young people that were running it, great Irish comics like Kevin Gildee and Barry Murphy, were incredibly generous spirited. It was really very collegiate, I don't know how else to put it, or cordial. You know, they were very kind and much kinder than young men usually are, and welcoming, and people were absorbed, and a kind of a gang formed, you know. And then we had a great time for a few years.
And you would have, what, still a teenager?
Oh, yeah, I was 19 or something, yeah.
I wonder what you would have talked about.
Nothing very,
you know. Imagine what you were drawing on.
You know, the usual stuff young guys talk about, their relationships, and, you know, it's all very simple stuff at that stage. But it was good, and it was not nasty. Because I sort of realised that afterwards, being in, you know, bigger cities where there were more clubs. It was very verbal. It was about language. You know, it was you know, the emphasis tends to be in comedy clubs. People always think, you know, you're talking about sex or, you know, something very in your face or, you know, very, very, you know, down to earth all the time. There was that, but there was also more sort of airy-fairy, experimental, speculative stuff that was quite good fun and characters and things that would come on. There would be no explanation, something would be just happening in front of you. So it was really exciting, you know, and some of it was terrible as well. And it was all real grab bag. You didn't know what you were going to get. You know, something would be just wonderful, a perfectly realized bit of madness, and then something else would just be the most awful cluster of personality problems somebody was trying to deal with on stage. And it was one thing after the other, and then there'd be a song, you know, and then something else strange. So it was great.
Did you get paid?
Oh, you know, nominal amounts of drinking money. 10 quid here, 20 quid there, you know, and then if you went somewhere and did it, got 50 quid, that was a big deal.
So it mustn't have seemed like a possible job, or did it? Like, did he think, is this going to be...
Well, it was a possible focus, I guess, you know, and then, you know, you did that for a while and you thought about it a lot and you tried to get good at it. And yeah, you know, you had a kind of a... It was a backyard where you could do a lot of play pretend and see if you could get any better at it, because then I moved over to London and they had 100 clubs you could work every night of the week.
When you first were going on stage, Dylan, were you inventing a persona, or was it just you dialed up?
I don't know. I've no training. There's no drama school. There's no university. There's nothing. So there's no development of any kind of critical faculty that would allow me to describe all this stuff. You do it and you're doing it.
So what made you laugh, though? I mean, you must have been someone who, were you the kid trying to make other people laugh, or were you watching TV? Was it family, the ways people spoke?
All of those things. But the people who really, you know, I read a lot. So, I liked funny stuff. So the people who are making you laugh consistently, your family make you laugh because they're crazy and sometimes somebody's very funny. But the people who make you laugh consistently are professionals. And I was interested in that. You know, I was interested in what is it these people are doing, because they're locking down on something. What is it that they're isolating, you know? And I kind of did that. I was interested in that, in looking at it and doing it for longer. Because I suppose, because like I say, the surround was pretty boring and bleak at the time. I didn't really want to look at it too much. It was pure escapism, I guess, on one level.
How did the decision to move to London come about? Was that an inevitable sort of journey that
Yeah, it was. You know, did you want to make a living? That's how you make a living, because you couldn't make a living in Dublin. You could hang out with your friends and, you know, have some money on Wednesday and no money on Thursday. You could do that. But if you wanted to, like, take a shot at making a living, doing something you wanted to do, as in not going and getting a job that where you're just, you know, working to live, but actually go and do something you want to do, that was the circus. So I ran away and joined the circus in London, because there were 100 comedy clubs or whatever it was. And then you go and you do what they call, you know, open spots, where you're working for free, traveling all over the city on the tube, you know, paying to get there and back, and to show yourself to the club owner. And of course, they, you know, some of them were bastards and ripped you off and exploited that power. You know, they'd make you come out and you'd do a show for nothing and so on, maybe a couple of times. But generally, the culture was supportive, and you get rolling and get booked. You know, it's such a hand-to-mouth, scratchy sort of existence. You know, I don't know, people see stars, you know, they see comedy stars or music stars or whatever, and they think everybody's rich. You know, it's down on the ground when you're hustling. I mean, it's a huge hustle. It's a huge hustle. And I just looked at anybody who was any good. But then when you do that in detail, you see, like, oh, that person's just kind of, they're good because they're professional, you know, and they sort of dot their I's and cross their T's. But that person's good because they're not fully in control of their talent, but they've got something. So they sometimes could be very compelling. You know, your John Belushi's or whatever. Somebody who's just got some sort of electricity, but they can't always handle it themselves properly. That's always exciting to watch. You know, there's a million ways to do it.
Was it a big culture shock coming
from
Ireland?
Yeah, because I'm a hick, you know. I'm from a small, pretty small town in Ireland. Like I say, I was a mile out of the town, so I was out and bombing around on my bike in the trees all day long, all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, I'm in the middle of London.
Was it exciting?
It was exciting, but it was also super stressful, because you had to hit it every night, and the culture was different. Like I said, I came from this very, you know, talky, dilatory kind of, you know, let's see what's happening way of looking at things in Dublin, where people were experimental, down to London, where you had to hit it, bang, 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 you know, deliver. Make me laugh now. I'm tired. It's Friday night. I've come out of the office. I haven't eaten anything. I've had 6 or 8 drinks. I'm kind of a bit leery and, you know, make me laugh now. And you know, I was a scared 20-year-old hick from Ireland. And that, you have to learn fast or you don't make it.
Did you ever come off stage or think that I do not want to do this?
Mm-hmm. A lot. Yeah. I mean, definitely I did that a bit because it was just, even when it went well. Sometimes, yeah, it wasn't about, you know, not being able to do it. It was just about, oh, this didn't feel, it felt aggressive. There was a lot of aggression in it. That was a bit of a culture shock to me.
And the fact that you were an Irishman, were there certain stereotypes about the kind of comic you were meant to be or the way you were supposed to?
Yeah, but again, it was something that I was made aware of by the odd people, the odd person who'd make a comment or whatever, but it wouldn't even occur to me. I didn't see things that way. You know, I didn't look at people and look at them through the, oh, you're English, you're Irish, whatever. I didn't think like that. I just tried to deal with people as they were individually. You use it in the end. You try to absorb everything. Oh, you see, that's the perception. Okay, what can I do with that? You know, I'll bank that and maybe see if I can turn that around on somebody sometime later. But yeah, I think it was that small town, big city culture. That was the biggest shock more than anything, more than Ireland or England or any of that. And I've spent so much time now, I'm 48, I've spent so much time living between the two countries. I was born in London, I was raised in Ireland, I lived in the north, made my bones or whatever you want to call it in London. And now I live in Scotland. So I've lived all over the islands. I'm jumping around all the time. I all these little differences where people bang on about you're from here, I'm from there. I don't give a crap about that because, you know, look at it. Look at it compared to Australia, for God's sake. You know, you're talking about
the next suburb.
A tiny, yeah, exactly. You're talking about suburbs.
Were hecklers something that you had to contend with in those London audiences?
Yeah, that was what was different and shock. That was the culture shock, was that you realise, oh, this is about crowd management. This is about dominating a room. And that was something I sort of had to, I could do that from home, from learning that from people around you, you know, how people sort of make other people listen to them. But I thought it was strange that people, that's what we do, you know, not people, but me, everybody. That's what we, it seemed like, that still seems a strange thing to me that we sort of, we like to turn ourselves off and let somebody lead for a while. And you sort of get annoyed with somebody if they don't pick up the mantle. And lead. I mean, look at politics right now. Look at the people we're electing. We want people who we seem to be electing in the English speaking world. We seem to be electing people who we don't particularly rate, just because we know they'll dominate a room. You know.
So as you living this life, Dylan, of playing as any whatever gigs you can, this kind of hand to mouth existence, traveling around the UK, how did TV enter the picture?
Oh, you know, you get asked, you know, when you're a young guy and you're bumming around doing clubs, you don't, I mean, I didn't certainly wasn't, I didn't know how to, you know, get that going. I sort of thought, I didn't think about it. I got told to think about it and I went, oh, really, do I have to think about that now? Because I just sort of feel like crack the stand-up thing. And then as soon as you do that, everybody's saying, you know, do a series, write a sitcom, all that stuff. I wrote a stage pilot for Black Books, which was on in a theatre. It was crazy in London. And that was very intense, you know, writing and being in that. I had fantastic people, obviously, to work with. And, you know, Tamsin and Bill were amazing. And we had a good time, you know. We had a good time and it was all very intense. And I was pretty slow about it. I didn't realise everybody was supposed to knock 6 or 8 of something out a year. There were huge gaps in between the series. And everybody go, are you ready to do the second one or the third one? I go, yeah, okay, let's have a look. But I didn't, I was
and
no
there was
hurry.
Only 3 series.
Yeah. People
me.
Make far too much of everything these days.
3 was enough. That show was filmed in front of a live audience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, was that important? You know, was that part of keeping your game up?
Here's the thing. I cannot emphasize how little foreknowledge, control. I never knew what I was doing. I never knew what was coming. It was very random. And I had no foreknowledge or control. And then what happens is the only way you can do anything is you get good at something. And then somebody says, do you want to do it? And the only power you have as an act is saying yes or no. And if you're good at something and you say yes to something you don't want to do, you'll do it badly. And it will damage what you can do and your confidence. It's pretty fragile, to be honest with you. And then if you say, okay, I want to do it this way, sometimes it really annoys everybody else who you need to make it work. And if you don't do that, though, if you don't step up and say, well, I'm sorry, but that's how it is, you're going to damage your own talent. Because what you've got is this pretty fragile little thing you've got to protect. because what it can do is generate stuff that's big and powerful. But you don't go in knowing what's going to happen when you jump out the window. You just have to jump out the window.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Dylan, we were talking about the TV series Black Books, which you co-wrote and starred in. The setting is a bookstore that your character, Bernard Black, runs, but he just hates his customers. Were you familiar with booksellers like that?
Yes, and it was inescapable because that's right. Those men were everywhere. They're all not exclusively running those shops, but the vast majority of them were people who didn't want to deal with reality and having to make a living, and they wanted to. And I related to that because comedy was an escape for me. I didn't want to deal with the reality of, you know, having to earn money to live by doing something I didn't want to do. And they obviously loved books and literature. They didn't, and they knew they had to live. So they were trying to do something that they could love and live with, but also suffering because they had to keep dealing with people and stuff that was extraneous to their concern.
Let's hear a little bit from Bernard.
Just look at this bastard. That's right. That's right. We're having lunch. Come on in. Look at him. Look. What do they want from me? Why can't they just leave me alone? I mean, what do they want from me?
Well, they want to buy books.
Yeah, but why me? Why do they come to me?
Because you sell books.
Yeah, I know, but...
That is Dylan Moran playing the character of Bernard Black in the TV series Black Books, showing how he feels about having customers who dare come into the store and want to buy a book from him. Is it kind of perverse that people love hearing someone be so rude?
I think it's definitely this vicarious element of it. You know, everybody wanting to tell people to piss off. Definitely, yeah, definitely. There's something therapeutic. I mean, there is something very compelling. You know, you see those people every now and again still, and especially if they have a little platform in their own shop or business, or, you know, where nobody can really tell them to stop. They're kind of amazing because you think, wow, how are you getting through the day? How are you getting around? How is everybody near you getting around? You know, I am fascinated by those people. You know, we used to just call them difficult people, and I think the culture's probably moved on a bit because we try to be more respectful of whatever it is they've got going on, you know? But the fact is they're pretty difficult to deal with.
And I guess what's kind of delightfully perverse about Bernard is that he's one of those people who's in a role where they're meant to be about customer service. They're meant to be about being helpful, and that's what makes his rudeness even more outrageous, I guess. Yeah. He's not just a random rude person.
Well, Freud said, you know, the Irish are the only race that don't have a subconscious at all. It's all there. So I think that's the thing with him. It's all on the surface. You know, you can see it. There's no hiding. What I'm showing you is it's all on the surface, and you need to preserve this kind of, you know, indoorsy outdoorsiness of your own character to do what I'm doing in a way that interests me. Because I don't want to go to see somebody who's just professionally standing out there slinging out zingers. I'm not interested, because that means, as far as I'm concerned, I'm looking at somebody who's not really home. The lights are not really on. So I'd rather talk to somebody who is making it. I had to attend a bit more closely, maybe, or work out what they meant or what they were trying to say, but at least feel that that's them.
How did the success of Black Books change things for the other work that you were doing just professionally?
Well, you know, I was filling theatres before Black Books, but obviously what happened was it was easier to fill theatres afterwards. That's what happens. People come. And that was great for stage work, for live work, because it means you work more and you're busier and you get better faster. You get much better faster and you try more things. And also the other thing is, you know, it's a vote of confidence from an audience. So people are coming. They're interested in what you're doing. You've shown you can do something that people like. And it's a kind of, it gives you a lot of energy. And you try more stuff and you get better. That's actually what happens, is you get better pretty fast. Kind of exponentially, really. Because you've just had this huge boost. And that was great for a while.
Did people want to see Bernard Black? Was that already close enough to what you
were
doing?
There was an element of that. And I think I found that I kind of probably stiffened into, I didn't realize it at the time, but I think over the years, I struggled a bit with that latterly, you know, that it was too like, not in my mind like Bernard, but just that I'd used those kind of tropes of misanthropy and people finding it hard to get through the day a lot. And to be honest with you, I've got bored of that because it's boring in the end. It is, you know, because that's the stuff that'll actually kill you in the end. If you those crazy guys in those shops or businesses, you know, they're funny, but they're not funny 30 years later. Desperately difficult to be around 30 years later, you know, and they don't want to be around either. So you've got to change, you know, you've got to change it.
Your stand-up career, Dylan, takes you all around the place. You've toured right around the world, it seems like. Is it true that you were the first English language comic to perform in Russia?
I don't know. I'm sorry about the I don't know.
Well, you went to Russia.
I went to Russia. As far as I know, some big American comic said to me, you weren't the first. I went, but he went to some private oligarch birthday party. So does that count?
You played to the people.
I played to the people in a theater in Moscow, and 800 people came, and I couldn't believe it. You know, we filled the theater, this beautiful old theater, and it was really weird. And I had to do this. I was so into it. I was the most excited I'd been in years about performing anywhere because I'd read lots of Russian literature and I was interested in the country. And I met these wonderful Russian comics who were very kind to me, and we set up this gig. And people came, and it was like a sort of Victorian. I felt like I was presenting some sort of Victorian slideshow lecture because I would say something, there would be a slight pause, and then laughter, and then applause, and then a pause, and then I would say something else, and there'd be a slight pause, and then laughter, and then applause all night. It's real stately rolling progress of this show, but there was connection, and that was all.
And did you expect that?
All you need. Well, you just don't know. You hope for it. You hope. It's all about hope, and then you get out there and hope it works. And I'm emphasizing this fragility and this hope and the confidence aspects because a lot of the time, the language around comedy, it's always very aggressive. You know, it's like I went out there and I killed and I slayed and all. It's all about dominance. But the truth is, you know, it's much more Chinese, frankly, in the important aspects. It's about a confluence of energies and things being right and trusting and being receptive, and I have to surrender quite a lot to the audience as well, and they have to surrender to me. There's a lot of, it's all about the back and forth rather than this kind of thing of coming out and clubbing people. That's basic stuff.
I guess though, performing in Russia in a place that's sort of so renowned for censorship and mm-hmm. political violence and political oppression, such a different context than playing in London. Were you thinking there are things I can't say or shouldn't say?
Of course. I just read a couple of Edward Lucas books he's the Russian specialist who writes for The Economist, and he scared the shit out of me with his book. But you go over as a Westerner, and what you're really obsessed with is Kremlinology. And not life as it's lived on the street by Russians. Because all we hear about is the political aspect of it. So, and that's grossly unfair to Russians, who have, plenty of whom have, you know, nothing good to say about their government. And I wanted to talk to people. And then what happens is, you know, X goes over to Y, to country Y, and, you know, therefore they're breaking a sanction, or they're ignoring the plight of the people. But you're not, actually. What you're doing is you're trying to talk to people. And then, you know, there's the danger that I can be manipulated into being presented as you being ignorant or compliant with whatever's going on. But I just wanted to talk to people. And I did. And it was very, very, you know, interesting and a good thing, you know.
Were there any parts of Russia that reminded you of Ireland?
Loads of it, powerfully. Because of the hypocrisy and the double standards and the censorship and not being able to talk about certain things. Absolutely. And the techniques used by the Russian government are very similar to the ones used by the Catholic Church in terms of oppression and creating a culture of fear. So, you know, that's what people live with. But of course, what happens is that in the same way that people did in Ireland, they park it so that they live a parallel life all the time. They live a kind of a dual existence because there's the nods and grins they have to do in obeisance to the system. And then there's real life. you know, and they're not the same thing. And people who live in the West, us here in the West, who are very confident that we live this sort of more unified existence where we don't have to, you know, pretend to a government just so they won't come and beat us up. That idea bears some scrutiny up to a certain point. But, you know, you look at it and then our lives are pretty fragmented as well.
What was it like beyond the time that you were on stage in Russia to spend time there? I mean, it's such an astonishing place to be.
Yeah. It's hard. It's a hard life. It's a hard life for a lot of people. And I was just in the cities. I was just in Moscow and Petersburg, you know, and then you read about the countryside and what goes on out there. I mean, it's brutal. It's bitter, you know. So we are lucky, you know, obviously here, don't get me wrong. I'm saying we're very lucky in the West to enjoy democracy and freedom. We completely are because it's...
Maybe
it's,
there's even more of a hunger for, I don't know if this is too trite a thing to say, but for like having a break from the hardness of that life, to just go and sit down and laugh for 2 hours.
Yeah, they have a fantastic culture of comedy in Russia. I mean, their stuff is hilarious. I mean, check out Chekhov's little things he called his vaudevilles, the little sketches, the vignettes. They're hilarious.
I think one of the things you spoke about in that gig was about a famous visit that I can remember being reported here when Yeltsin visited Ireland.
That's right. Yeah.
What was that? What's that story?
Well, the plane landed and, you know, all the assembled Irish dignitaries, the then Taoiseach Albert Reynolds was there. There was trumpeters and red carpets and the whole bit. And the Russian jet lands with Yeltsin on it. It sits on the tarmac for a little bit. Everybody's waiting, thinking, okay, you know, is Boris going to decant from the plane? Are we going to get to meet him sometime this afternoon? It sits there. And then it takes off again because his people on board said, look, mate, you're too drunk. You're not getting off this plane. So they took off again.
What did all the Irish dignitaries do who were down there waiting?
They probably said, yeah, we've all had days like that.
So it was something you could share with that Russian audience,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, that stuff. And the audiences were ridiculously giving the stage. It was covered in chocolate and vodka and all kinds of tributes.
The question of censorship, it's a funny one because, I mean, I've heard male comics here complain, oh, it's too constrained now what we can make jokes about. We don't know what it's safe to make jokes about. Do you feel any of that anxiety?
No, personally, but I feel that... We are going through a period where generationally there's been a shift where the younger people have said, you know, this just doesn't go anymore. Whatever example you might care to use, there are many right now. And older people are, some of them are not listening at all. I count myself as an older person at this stage, and I think I'm very interested in what you think are the new rules, because of course these are waves. They never stop. This is the ocean of our sensibilities. It never stops rolling, you know, and we're redefining ourselves every generation. And it's sort of it's hilarious. You know, it's very telling when somebody's letting it be known what goes and what doesn't anymore. You get a sense of their understanding of history pretty quickly, because the fact is, you know, plus the chance, a lot of the time, it really doesn't change that much, you know. Nobody respects their parents and everybody's writing a book was a complaint made by Cicero. So look around, you know, the news is not often, it's not news. It's just the same old, same old.
It's interesting that ABC recently did this massive poll into people's opinions, like 54,000 people or something they interviewed on this series called Australia Talks, just to find out attitudes towards things. And overwhelmingly, I think, you know, more than two-thirds of people they asked, right across age and demographics and gender and ethnicity, et cetera, everyone said, yeah, political correctness has gone too far. There was this huge support for that. But then the questions about should there be more respect in society, is free speech always okay? Most people agreed with that as well.
Yeah, you phrase it about how you phrase it, isn't it, a lot of the time. I think what is happening now that's of much more importance than that really is younger people's voices around these real issues like climate change and so on. I'm not saying the other issues are not real, but they are so dependent on sensibility and personality, you know? I mean, just generally more sense of inclusiveness and plurality is, you know, to my liberal branch of the tree is a good way to go. And I think people who are talking about, what I love though, it makes me laugh, is those people who say, yes, we have to include these people and those people, but not those people. I love it when there's one group that people leave out, whether it's, you know, trans people or people from over there or people with this religious belief, whatever it is. I just think that's hilarious that there's always one group they manage to exclude. You're either saying everybody's included or you're not.
You referred to yourself a moment ago as an older comic. What kind of material is there in midlife that's made you stop short and think, I'm going to be able to laugh about this, or I need to be able to laugh about this?
Well, what happens, I think, is once you get over a certain point in your life, I don't know where, it's probably changes, it's different for everybody, but there's a certain point you realize, oh my God, laughter is not an optional thing. This is survival. If you don't have this on a daily basis, you're screwed. You have to, you have to develop your own sense of humor in time. It has to get deeper. It has to get richer. It has to get more inclusive. And it has to get wilder in a way, because what's happening to you is wilder.
Because the face of your own decay and mortality.
Exactly. It just, the progress of it is ferocious, and it's a constant. You have to have a sense of humor to give everything to a fight you know you're going to lose.
There can be a tendency in middle age to try and shore oneself up against that decay and looming mortality by getting obsessed with houses and kitchens, with stuff and with status.
Yeah. Well, I think that's hilarious. You know, it is. You cannot shore up anything against anything. It's all going to blow away. So, you know, you either make your peace with that, or you get very busy and stay in a flop sweat for the remainder of your days trying to, you know, build a dam of some bulwark against the inevitable, or you just sort of get more interested in what's coming at you.
Your Bernard Black in Black Books was constantly drunk or on the way to being drunk or terribly hungover.
Yeah.
You don't drink anymore.
No, not anymore. I got too tired.
What's that like as a change from something that was a big part of who you were to not being a part?
Well, you know, I drank as well because it was for a million reasons. It was social. It was social glue of where I grew up. You know, as soon as you were sort of, I don't know, 15, 16, everybody was drinking and socializing. And then, you know, it completely oils the gears of the stage world, theater world. It's everywhere. And the club world, you know, it was just around. I mean, it was just like, you know, wallet, shoes, drink, you know, you're dressed. That's okay. That's not a great outfit, but
that's a really specific club.
Yeah. They're only open on Thursdays. But it's just around all the time. I mean, I come from Ireland, for God's sake, you know, from the 1970s. I mean, people were drinking, driving to work, and in London as well, you know, God, in the 90s. It was crazy, actually, back then, all the time. And, you know, you're going from gig to gig, and sometimes you would do two or three in a night. You know, you play one club in one part of town, you jump in the tube, you do another one, you might get three done one night, you know, and you're sort of fueling yourself with drinks. And then, you know, you do that for a few years, and you don't even realize how frayed you are, you know, by the end of it. And I just had to stop because it felt like driving a car uphill with the brakes on for years. I said, what am I doing? It's not only a job, it's a really hard job. This is really difficult. I have to get upside down naked into the forklift and make it go up the hill again. And I just got tired of doing it. And I thought, maybe there's some way I can, seriously, it actually felt like cheating. I'm not kidding. I really, when I stopped drinking, first I thought, I'm cheating essentially. I shouldn't be allowed to do comedy anymore because I don't feel like I'm dying every single second I'm awake.
So it wasn't harder to do comedy sober?
No. I mean, but it was different. You know, it was different. It was harder in some ways. And that, you know, it's a huge, one thing that alcohol is good at doing, it's good at sort of putting a knot in your nerves, you know, just kind of tying off the whole bundle of cables that are sparking over around, flopping around the floor. It sort of ties them up and jams them into a corner for a while. Then all that energy go somewhere else, you know, so you've got to contain that energy. You know, it's the whole battle of libido and morbido constantly at each other, or yin and yang, or whatever you want to think of it as. So how do you hold the line, you know, and not get thrown around the room yourself? That's what it's all about. Because I think a lot of people on stage, what I'm trying to get at is, this is me talking about what the experience is actually like now, because it's much more, it's less, a lot less intellectual, it's far more emotional, it's far more, you know, about a survival, it's on a survival level. there was no consideration. It was all about impulsive desperation, you know, and the drinking was part of that. It was, I think it is for a lot of people on stage, where you're just trying to get a handle on things, you know, and it did that for a while. It's a weird life. It's a very weird life. You know, you're getting off a plane or a train or something, you're rolling into a town you don't know that much about, and you're going to start talking to people and telling them what's what. And then you're going to get out of there and do it again the next day somewhere else. I mean, it's madness. You're sort of this mobile Hitler with jokes. And alcohol just helped the whole thing make sense, you know?
What was it like the first night to go on stage without holding on to a glass of wine?
I've done it a few times over the years, and it's always a white-knuckle ride, to be honest with you. You know, it's always like, you can hear the air roaring past you as you're doing it, you know, because being happy on stage is really about slowing time down. You know, I always compare it to if you've ever fallen, tripped as an adult, you know, when time slows down, because your body goes into this, it's an autonomic response, everything falls down, you go, oh, I see I'm falling through the air, if I twist this way, I might not smash my face. It's like that. All the time. It's a slow kind of crash that you're trying to control, you know? So what alcohol did was very good at as well, was just kind of helping you sashay from one move to the next. It helped the jazz flow, you know? But without it, you sort of have to find it in a different way. You have to trust yourself a bit more, you know?
Dylan Moran, thanks for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you very much for having me.
I spoke with the comic Dylan Moran in 2019. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.